Hey, everybody, I'm Nick Layton.
And I'm Leah Bonema.
And we're the hosts of Were You Raised by Wolves?
Each week, we try to make the world a kinder, nicer place.
Well, that's the idea, at least.
I mean, we try.
Have you ever wondered what to do if you're ghosted?
Or what to do when a friend asks you to borrow money?
Or the proper way to eat Cheetos?
You know, the big questions.
So please find Were You Raised by Wolves wherever you listen.
Today's program is proudly brought to you by Whole Foods Market. Visit wholefoodsmarket.com or download the Whole Foods Market app to learn more and find the store nearest to you.
You're listening to Heritage Radio Network. We're a member-supported food radio network broadcasting over 35 weekly shows live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. Join our hosts as they lead you through the world of craft brewing, behind the scenes of the restaurant industry, inside the battle over school food, and beyond. Find us at heritageradionetwork.org.
Hey, and welcome to the food scene on heritageradionetwork.org. I'm your host, Michael Harlan Turkell. And today, let's call Olivia Mack McCool the lunch lady, but not that atypical vision of someone manning steam tables and scooping slop onto plastic trays in a cafeteria. Instead, McCool has made a career of making beautiful dishes as a food stylist, which leads her to transform how we look at our midday meal with lunch, published by W&P's Dovetail Press. This is a 10-week guide to reclaiming the most important meal of the day. And McCool reorganizes your pantry, cleans up your fridge, and preps you for Sunday shopping, enlivening the upcoming work week. So sad duck desk lunches be damned. Welcome to the show, Olivia.
Hey, Michael.
So we have a lot other than lunch to talk about, because I want to frame who you are, a New Jersey girl by way of North and South Italy.
True.
What is the biggest influence, or what is the biggest preconception of what being an Italian-American is in New Jersey, food-wise?
Oh, that's a loaded question. So there's obviously lots of preconceived notions about Italian-Americans in New Jersey. There was a whole television show about it.
Oh, I've heard of that
one. Yes. Well, so as I was telling you, one of my fathers, I have two dads, one of my fathers is from southern Italy, one from the north, and we grew up with really a lot less of what you would call Italian-American food, more Italian food, which I'm not dissing either. I mean, they both have an equal place in this world. But, you know, Italian-American food is really its own thing in the sense of, you know, especially in New Jersey, we've got gabbadil and gabagol. And
oh, well, can you interpret those things for
me?
Oh,
yeah. So I am a translator.
Yeah.
Yes. I've done this many times for people. So gabbadil is actually cavatelli, which is a type of pasta, if you don't know. Gabagol is capicola.
Yes, I thought it was. I had this situation in a deli, and the woman was asking, and I'm like, I think it's an onomatopoeia for this kind of meat.
Yeah, it's actually capicola.
Yeah.
mozzarella, easy one. Prosciutto, also an easy one. Yeah, I think that's some big ones.
I feel like with this language that surrounds Italian-American food in general, there's such a large conversation that happens within the Italian-American community about food, too. And your family is a prime example of speaking ad nauseum about all the great feasts that you have, but while eating a meal, what you're going to eat for the next meal.
Seriously, yes. So the first time that my now husband, Pat, the first time he ever had dinner with my family, which at the time consisted of my two dads, my sister, maybe some random, you know, friends of my dad's. So we always have these big dinners. And the first time he came to dinner, he left dinner and he said, I have never been with a family that talks about food so much while they're eating food. I mean, it's the only thing that consumes our conversations at the dinner table, which, you know, it is about the food we're eating and how good it is. It's about, well, who would do it a little better? It's about the last time we ate this food. It's about the next time we're going to eat it. It's about, actually, next time let's introduce clams. Let's, you know, and it's kind of all we talk about. I don't know if it's an excuse to not talk about other things, but who knows, you know.
Well, this always being on the pulse or on your mind, it only made sense that you went to Le Cordon Bleu, that you found a career in food somehow. But did you expect that at a young age?
So the only thing I expected at a young age was, all I knew was that I wanted to live in New York City. I wanted to be sophisticated. I wanted to throw dinner parties. At a very young age, I knew this. I also wanted to stay out as late as I wanted to without any interference, but that's another subject. So at that time, I didn't know that I would have a career in food. I never really thought about what my career would be. When I graduated from high school, I went to art school. I went to FIT and studied fashion and specifically textile design. And then while I was in college, my father married a woman, and so it was my stepmother. My stepmother's stepmother was and is a prop stylist in New York City. And, you know, I was 19 years old, and she said, "Do you want to just help me out on set for like a couple bucks, extra bucks?" I said, "Yeah, sure." So then I came on set, and I was on Tiffany jobs and, you know, big makeup ads, and it was really exciting. And I loved it. So when I graduated from college, I started working for her as her assistant, and I worked for her for 5 years. And one day she said to me, "You know, I love you. You're great at this, but I know you don't want to be a prop stylist." I said, "Yeah, no, I don't." She said, "Well, you have to figure out what you want to do." So I had always loved food, and I was obsessed with eating. I was obsessed with cooking as a kid. I was obsessed with the Food Network. And so my whole family was like, "Liv, go to culinary school. You know, you should have always gone." So I was fortunate enough, because culinary school is very expensive. I was really fortunate that my family was able to help me out. And I wanted to travel too. So I went to Le Cordon Bleu in Paris, and I spent about 6 months there studying and eating and drinking a lot and, you know, living in Paris and how exciting that was. And I definitely, of course, I learned so much there, because you're immersed with French technique all day, every day. But I have to say, the bulk of what I know and the bulk of what you're going to read in the book is really, it sounds crazy, it's things I learned on the Food Network. I was obsessed when I was a kid. All I would do, I didn't watch MTV. I didn't watch Nickelodeon. All I wanted to do was watch the Food Network. And these women, Ina and Giada, like, taught me. I mean, that's how I learned how to cook. And the other thing is, I grew up without a mom. So it was sort of sink or swim, in the sense of, even though my dads are very good cooks. They're amazing cooks. But, you know, they're busy and they're men. And you know, it was different. So, I started cooking at a very young age.
Well, there's a big difference between being able to talk about food and being able to talk about it in a visual manner. And that's what you do, not only as a prop stylist, but then parlaying that into food styling. That's a whole other vocabulary, language that you have to have with other people on set, a photographer, a creative director. How do you gain that lexicon? How do you gain that knowledge?
So part of it is definitely instinctual. I've always been really artistic. Took every single art class possible in high school and grammar school, and obviously I went to design school, but mainly it's from assisting. So the next part of the story is when I got back from Le Cordon Bleu, I kept working for that prop stylist because I needed to make money, but I had met food stylists while working with her naturally on set. So I just emailed a bunch of food stylists that, little did I know, they were the best of the best. I worked for Susan Spungen for a while, who I'm sure you know, and I worked for Victoria Granoff for a very long while. And that experience it's invaluable. I mean, I was really lucky that especially Victoria really trusted me and let me do a lot of things, you know, so I was really hands-on. And there's just, you can't learn that any other way than by assisting and doing it. And I think food styling has become, or being a food stylist has become now like a household name in the sense of like people now know what food stylists are. And I don't want to say that, you know, there are some people on now with Instagram and that are food style. I'm doing air quotes for the people.
Oh, we can feel it.
You can feel it. Yeah. And that's all fine and well, but there's just that assisting experience is nothing. You can't buy that.
Yeah,
you can't buy that.
And it's absurdly invaluable in many ways because you also kind of vet what works and what doesn't rather than just replicate and emulate what works.
Completely.
And with that, I want to talk about another term, visualization, because we've talked about some of the visual aspects, but what visualization is for me is what you've done in this book and what anybody who is a recipe developer does, that you have something in mind that you want to get to and use whatever foundational techniques you have to get there. But then there's the creative sense of not only how does it look, but how will people interpret this? And that's what I'm so impressed with by this book. Let's talk about lunch for a second. Mm-hmm. I mean, a lot of people don't really talk about lunch. You know, they talk about what they ate for breakfast and where they went out for dinner, but lunch has always been this blasé thing, you know, perfunctory even. Why do you think lunch has been relegated for so long, and why is this kind of book a necessity?
Well, because lunch is kind of the workhorse of the day. So, like, either you're eating lunch at your desk alone, or you're hopping out to, you know, in New York, everyone, like, goes out to Sweetgreen or whatever, salad joint, right? So you're kind of shoveling it down, and you're eating it alone. It's not too glamorous. And even if you go to lunch with somebody, right, you go to a ladies' lunch or something, oftentimes, especially in my life, it's work-related. So you're there kind of for a reason. And I think, you know, I mean, I'm a freelancer. I work from home a lot. So my lunch is often really, really good. And when I'm on set, even though a lot of the time lunch is provided, I like to bring my own lunch. Or on sets that, you know, I'm pretty friendly with the client and everything, I'll make everybody lunch. Even though it's a little bit of effort or more time, but I don't know, I love that sitting down, the day stops. Even on set, I'm sure you agree, like, I like to, everyone stop, let's sit down. And even if it's just 25 minutes, let's eat.
I mean, it's very European of you, very Italian of you.
Yeah, it's true.
You know, taking that time. It's so funny having just recently been to Italy and forgetting that there are certain times of the day where you can't go out to eat and can't get things done because everybody else is taking lunch.
That's hard as a New Yorker, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. Yeah. It's wild, but it also makes you step back for a second and take that time or reclaim that time for yourself. And again, this is what you're doing in this book. And I think the exclamation point on the title is not by mistake. You know, it's lunch. You're trying to shout this from, you know, the mountaintops and be emphatic about how good lunch can be. And what's also interesting is lunch doesn't have to be cooked at lunchtime.
Exactly. That's the key, right? We're all super busy. You know, lunch needs to get made. You need to bring it. You need to eat it. But I find that, so especially again with Instagram, people are always Instagramming their dinner or, you know, their drinks or whatever. I think that people could get really into Instagramming their lunch and being proud of it. When I was writing the book, of course, I'm a food stylist, right? So I was thinking about how the food would look at the photo shoot when we shot the food. But also in the sense of I love to eat food that looks really beautiful and not beautiful in a pea tendril or, you know, sprinkle of something kind of way. I mean beautiful, like colorful, that there's more than one color on the plate and that, you know, you eat with your eyes. And I don't see why every meal can't be like that. With a little bit of prep, a little bit of time put in, you know, you organize yourself a little bit and then you can end up with lunch like this every single day. It's possible.
Well, we're going to take a quick break and come back and talk about the 10-week guide to reclaiming your lunchtime and 5 delicious and healthy lunches in each section. You've been listening to The Food Scene on heritageradionetwork.org. We'll be right back.
Today's program is brought to you by Whole Foods Market. From papayas and samosas to reishi mushrooms, if it's something that sounds delicious, chances are you'll find the freshest, best version of it at Whole Foods Market. They have more than 400 stores across the country, so if you consider pizza its own food group or just can't imagine when avocado toast wasn't a thing, Whole Foods Market has you covered. Visit wholefoodsmarket.com to find a store near you. Whole Foods Market. Whatever makes you whole.
Hey, and welcome back to The Food Scene on HeritageRadioNetwork.org. I'm your host, Michael Harlan Turkel, here with Olivia Mack McCool. Is it interesting to hear that whole thing?
Yeah, it is, because it's new.
Yeah. It's how many weeks?
It's like a week and 2 days new.
Yeah. We'll talk about the fare that you had at your wedding, the spread of Italian-American food and fresh mozzarella pulling, if I'm correct. Mm-hmm. But let's talk about this 10-week, 5-recipe-per-week program that you have in this book. And I don't even want to call it a program. It is an education, because it really shows people how to, find certain aspects of lunch and being able to replicate those things in very different iterations. Chapter 1, chicken meatballs. Mm. Well, even before that, chicken stock. Taking the chicken and embracing that in 5 different ways. How do you do that for somebody who, gets palate fatigue or gets tired of eating the same thing over and over? How do you take that meatball and reinvent it?
So those meatballs specifically are really delicious. If you buy the book, that's the number one thing you should make. But it was interesting to me when I was writing this book, thinking about, there's a few lunch books out there. There's a few lunch bowl books out there, but each bowl is kind of a standalone recipe, right? So they don't incorporate the ingredients from the bowl before. And in reality, that's not how we eat and that's not how we cook. You buy things, you have them in your fridge, and you hopefully can make more than one meal out of them. So I give you, in each chapter, I give you a grocery list, and that grocery list is only what you need. And those fresh ingredients that you buy, I make a commitment to you that you're going to use them all by Friday. So there's no, herbs rotting in the fridge at the end of the week. So then you get a Sunday prep, and it's about 2 hours of work, maybe less if you're fast. And then the rest of the week should come together in a breeze. Now, in the sense of that chapter one, those chicken meatballs, they make an appearance in a noodle salad on Monday that has an amazing to die for fish sauce dressing. Then they make an appearance in, I think it's Tuesday, in this soup, right? So you build this soup base, you put it on the bottom of the bowl, you layer a bunch of stuff like thinly sliced mushrooms, like thin things that will cook fast. Then you put in the meatballs, and at work, you put hot water on top to make a soup. So even though it's the same chicken meatball, you're not really thinking, oh, this is the same meal, because it feels really different. There's different flavor profiles. And there are things that we have highlighted. I'm just speaking of my lovely editor.
The royal we.
The royal we. The we, I'm also speaking of my lovely editor, Muda, who helped me put together this book, have highlighted that there are some things you make on Wednesday night. So just one or two recipes that you might make on Wednesday night to keep it fresh, But I think program might not be the right word, but it is very formulaic in the sense that the instructions are spelled out for you. You get exactly what you need, and then you get 5 awesome lunches.
And it revolves around these 3 foci per week. So week 2's quinoa, halloumi beets, there's a week that soba noodles, salmon miso, but then sometimes one of the elements has been used up and gets swapped in. So this is where you start, but again, you get to show how you permeate off of that, how, these are starting points, but they're certainly, it's like a choose your own adventure book.
Yeah. And I, those ingredients, I chose them because a lot of them are very hearty, but at the same time, very healthy. And the other thing is I wanted to show people, in some instances, maybe they saw fish sauce in their supermarket, but they didn't know what to do with it. Or maybe they've heard of a certain ingredient and they can get it in their supermarket, but again, they don't know what to do with it. And I think for me personally, when I'm writing and recipe development and my Instagram and everything, I think it's so valuable to someone to show them what they can do with what they already can get, right? So accessibility in this book is key. There's nothing in this book that you're going to have to travel to some city to find. I mean, you can find 99% of these things in any supermarket across the nation. Or, you know, if there's one thing you have to order on Amazon, I tell you in the book, do it because it's worth it. And I would only include it if it's really worth it.
What are some of those that you highlight?
One of the chapters, I think a few of the chapters have a lot of sumac in it. And I really like sumac. I think it's something, but a lot of supermarkets these days have it. Whole Foods definitely has it. But I think it's something that is really exotic, but not exotic tasting. I mean, it's a little bit sweet. It's a little bit sour. It's really beautiful, too.
When you sprinkle, you know,
it creates that visual. But I mean, how amazing if you are not familiar with that and you start cooking with it and you're bringing your, you know, your flatbread lunch from chapter whatever into work and someone's like, oh, what's that? And you're like, oh, well, this is sumac. And I now know what it is and I now know what it tastes like and I know what to do with it now.
I mean, but how do you do that same thing with the humble chickpea?
Okay, yes, exactly. See, that's what's even more important to me is the humble chickpea, the humble lime, the humble lemon. I'm hoping that I'm teaching people what to do with those that might be a little different than what they've been doing or the boring lunches they've been packing. There's a really good chickpea recipe in here. It's this Moroccan spiced chickpea stew that, like a few of the things in the book, can be made vegetarian, vegan, or you can use chicken stock like I suggest to give more flavor. But the spices that you add to that stew, again, found in every supermarket, just might not be the combination that you would think to do or that you have been doing.
There are other great flourishes. There's a Moroccan carrot salad.
There are slaws.
There are pickled beets. There are seed sprinkles, which you have brought here today, and I'm having a hard time not having at the moment. What are the new pantry items or new things that everyone should have in their fridge at all time to be able to have delicious lunches?
I think really wholesome grains. Grains are a really touchy subject right now. Everyone has feelings about grains. You know, grains are real foods, like quinoa, like farro, barley. These are foods that if you don't have celiacs and they don't bother you or whatever, they're good for you. They're hearty. They fill you up, they don't spike your blood sugar, and they hold really well until lunchtime. That's the key as well. I think, you and I were talking earlier about avocado oil. And that I often, in this book, I call for grapeseed or avocado oil in a lot of the recipes. And grapeseed's a little more accessible. It's also less expensive. The reason why I love things like avocado oil, I don't think it tastes different. I don't think it necessarily even cooks better, but it's really a lot better for you. If you're going to pick a neutral oil to cook with, you know, if you don't want to cook with olive oil because you're cooking in high heat, it's really healthy for you. It's a little more expensive. So that's why there's a lot of options in the book, because I know some things are more expensive than other things or less accessible.
I mean, shopping in supermarkets has changed over the past decade alone. So you can go into a Costco and get nice organic olive oil in bulk, raw almonds, you know, really good things. So you spend your money there and you save money for other flourishes, you know, like that avocado oil. But you also talk about superfoods like fermented vegetables, turmeric, and one that I didn't know, which was the chlorophyll powder, the algae, Cholarella.
Chlorella?
Yes, that's the one. Butchered that well.
Well, so again, so superfoods, I like using that word. I know it's, I don't know if it's so mainstream or overused, but a lot of the foods I have in the book are superfoods, and that's why I've put them there, because again, back to kind of why lunch is so important, this meal, you really need your bang for your buck because you it's the middle of your day. You know, if you work at an office or, you know, you have meetings later, you got to have energy. We've all done it. Like you've all caved for the cheeseburger and then you feel like you're dying 30 minutes later. Like you need to run home and take a nap. But anyway, back to superfoods. I included a lot of that stuff because this is the meal you should be fitting all your healthy foods into. And I have a lot of nuts, a lot of seeds in the book, a lot of really good fats, which I know they're not, fats are not really considered superfoods, but for me they are because my body really reacts well to a lot of good quality fat. Quinoa, like I mentioned, beets. To me, beets are incredible. I love the way that they taste, but I love that, you know, they're really liver cleansing, and which I need. Anyone listening to this podcast that knows me knows I need the liver cleanse. And they're full of, you know, iron and any of these foods that are really colorful. You mentioned the Moroccan carrot slaw. I mean, that's like a beta carotene bomb that goes off at lunch, which is amazing. And this is what I was going for. You know, it's to pack as much healthy, quote unquote, food into your lunch.
But again, this book isn't about diet fads. It's about delicious things. And I want to talk about the worst lunch of all time. Not your worst lunch, but I think historically one of the worst lunches of all time may have been Thanksgiving. Because you see depictions of that, pictures, not actual pictures, but it's always during the daytime. Like, I've never seen it referenced as a dinner thing, even though I think Americans try to celebrate it as early dinner. In my mind, it's a lunch, and it's a terrible one at that, because it's antithetical to everything you're talking about and teaching in here. Yeah. And you are stuck on Thanksgiving right now as a food stylist.
Yes. In my world, it's been Thanksgiving over and over again, like Groundhog's Day. I have been cooking turkeys and stuffing and doing it while it's 80 degrees outside. But I agree with you. So it's funny, actually, my family, we don't do it earlier in the day. We're late eaters. We like to eat late. So Thanksgiving dinner is always pretty late for American standards.
When do you
get
your nap in then?
Yeah, exactly. I don't know. Yeah, there is no nap. That's just sleeping. But Thanksgiving is a prime example of when you eat like that, how you feel afterwards. And it's fine on Thanksgiving because there's football and couches and whatever. But you can't afford that on a work day. And all the lunches in the book, you're right, they are really healthy, but they're also super delicious. I consider myself a pretty healthy eater. I care about health and I care about wellness, but I only eat delicious. You know, like I'm only going to make something that's amazing and tasty and salty and, you know, delicious. So I don't sacrifice taste for that.
And we were joking around about Thanksgiving before and about how my favorite part is the day after sandwich, the lunch. And we won't let you go on that diatribe about why you hate sandwiches. But I mean, that is the only lunch thing that really comes out. It's reheating mashed potatoes and having that John Alden, you know, turkey stuffing cranberry sandwich. So it is very different than giving somebody a week's plan, five different meals based off of very similar base ingredients. Another event in your life, lots of food, was your recent wedding. And I want to talk about that just to, you know, there is lunch, which is supposed to fuel you and be this, you know, episodic thing that you have every day. But what do you do in an event-like setting such as a wedding? Do you have those same rules or ideologies about what to serve and what to eat?
Absolutely not. Absolutely not. Not only, yes, my wedding, I'm a big entertainer as well. I love entertaining at home. And some of the rules go out the window. But at our wedding, we had this great caterer from New Jersey called the Brownstone. They're very Italian-American. You know, we had wheels of Parmigiano. We had tons of prosciutto, goat cheese stuffed squash blossoms. But I think the highlight of the entire cocktail hour, and a lot of the wedding guests would agree, we had a guy pulling making and pulling fresh mozzarella and handing little bundles of it warm to people. When he handed it to you, it was warm. And if anyone has gotten married, you have had a wedding. In the moment, you're laser focused on other things than the food. You know, you've got all these guests. But my girlfriends, who are so amazing, they kept handing me plates of this warm mozzarella. I must have eaten my body weight in it. It was amazing. The food was awesome at our wedding. It was really fun.
Any leftovers that you then converted into lunches?
You know, the next day, that's what my husband and I said. I wish we had the leftovers from the cocktail hour right now. That's what we wanted. No, we had a bagel brunch, which is also classic New Jersey. I mean, if you haven't had bagels in New Jersey, in my opinion, you haven't had bagels. But we had a bagel brunch, which is definitely not in the rules for me usually. Refined carbs, no.
No, that's why you have the lunch booked to go back to your work week Monday through Friday.
Got
to
bounce back.
Exactly. Well, everyone should bounce over to wherever you can buy books and get lunch, and that is with an apostrophe from Olivia Mack McCool. It is a fascinating array of beautiful lunches that you can not only, you know, eat with your eyes, but eat and feel satiated. And they're just absolutely delicious. And I'm going to dig into that seed sprinkle very soon. Thank you again for being on. You've been listening to The Food Scene on HeritageRadioNetwork.org. I'm your host, Michael Harlan Turkell, hoping to have you back here next Tuesday at 3. A big thank you to our sponsor, Whole Foods, Music by Cookies, and Matthew Patterson for engineering. Cheers.
Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content and to hear about exclusive events, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at @heritage_radio. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Rate the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join our community by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening.
Hi, listeners. We want to tell you about a podcast we're really digging. It's called Christopher Kimball's Milk Street Radio. Every week, they travel the world to find the most fascinating stories about food, including children who harvest cod tongues after school in Norway, and a detective who tracks down food thieves. And on Milk Street Radio, you can always find the unexpected. The comedian who ranks apples using an elaborate 100-point system, the secret history of grocery stores, and how to eat your way through Italy. They also interview the most beloved names in food like Jacques Pepin, Sola Awele, Jose Andres, Jet Tila, Ina Garten, Nigella Lawson, and Padma Lakshmi. Plus, co-hosts Christopher Kimball and Sarah Moulton do live calls with listeners and answer their questions about ingredients, techniques, and culinary mysteries. Like, why roasting a leg of lamb made one caller's oven explode? Ever wonder why your bread won't rise or your souffle falls flat? Chris and Sarah have the answers. You'll also hear from a rotating cast of contributors, including Kenji Lopez-Alt, Cheryl Day, Dan Pashman from The Sporkful, and Alex Inouz, a French guy cooking from YouTube. Take a listen at 177milkstreet.com/radio or just search your podcast app for Milk Street Radio.